I would like to start this evening by reading the quote from the newsletter. The purpose of the spiritual life does not consist in acquiring benefits, honor, or fame, nor in gaining virtue, states of concentration, nor insight, and the eye of knowledge. The unshakable deliverance of heart, the sure heart's release, this and this alone is the object of the spiritual life, its essence, its true goal. From the Buddha. And some people maybe are quite surprised to read a statement like this, because he says that the purpose of our Buddhist practice, at least, is not even to attain states of insight or knowledge or understanding, but rather the sure heart's release, the deliverance of the heart. I sat a 10-day retreat ended yesterday with Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg, and Kamala Masters were teaching. And it was very nice to be able to sit. I hadn't been sat in retreat for some time. And one of the themes for the retreat, in some ways, was the idea of non-clinging. And Joseph gave a brilliant talk on Friday evening on non-clinging that then certainly inspired me. And one of the things he said, which you know, it's been my experience also in reading the Buddhist texts and the Buddhist sutras, is that the early Buddha, the Buddha from the early Pali Canon, talked repeatedly and over again about this, the goal of the spiritual life as being an experience or state or a way of being that involves non-clinging. And that's one of the primary ways of defining the goal of a spiritual life is non-clinging, not. And he doesn't often talk about, he sometimes uses other kind of synonyms for that, and he talks about peace or calmness or bliss or happiness. But it's usually understood that you have to take those words kind of with a grain of salt, because the conventional understandings of those words, of the positive attributes of this highest goal, are very dangerous if stated positively, because then we get very quickly attached to tranquility or peace or certain kind of flavors of happiness. But if you say non-clinging, that's like a negative about something, and so you're not really reifying or objectifying what the state of freedom is. And even, you know, maybe you don't even want to use the word freedom. And the Buddha seldom used the word freedom in his language, but rather he used the word release or the quenching. In this English translation, it talks about deliverance of the heart or the release of the heart. So I was sitting this retreat, and one of the experiences that I had, or inspirations I had, was once again a deepening appreciation of the Four Noble Truths. 20 years ago, I visited a friend, and she asked me. I was already involved with Zen practice then quite deeply, but I was a new kind of Zen student. So she asked me, you know, what is Buddhism about? And so I told her it's about the Four Noble Truths. And for those of you who might not know, it's the truth that there's a universal experience or common experience that we have of suffering in the world, that we can't really deny that there is suffering. Not that everything is suffering, but there certainly is suffering. And that the kind of suffering that Buddhism is concerned about arises out of clinging, out of attachment or strong craving. And so it's a second truth, is that suffering arises out of craving. And the third truth is that there's a possible to quench or to calm or end the suffering, to end the clinging, to have an experience of non-clinging, of cessation, of nirvana. And the fourth truth is that there's a path you can follow. There's a way of proceeding that that opens up the world of non-clinging to a person. So I said something like that to this, my friend, and I left her feeling somewhat inadequate or embarrassed. That's all I could say about Buddhism. It seemed like a really silly, simple thing to say, and I knew that Buddhism was this big philosophical system with lots of, you know, deep doctrines and ideas, and I just had said these very simple Four Noble Truths, and felt a little bit embarrassed by my lack of understanding. But now that I've 20 years later and I've perhaps matured a little bit more in my practice, I feel that that the Four Noble Truths are very, very profound teachings in Buddhism. And even though it can be stated very quickly and easily, and most people can understand them in very short order, to really understand the depth of how they apply to our life is something which I think is a lifetime process. And it's said in Buddhism that only someone who's fully realized the final stages of realization really understands the Four Noble Truths in their depth. And it's quite remarkable to do a meditation practice or a mindfulness practice, especially to go on retreats, and you become familiar with the workings of the mind and the thoughts. And to begin seeing the full spectrum of both suffering and the cravings, the clinging that causes suffering. And there's, you know, monumental suffering that people have in their lives, great tragedies that people have, and tragedies that happen, you know, one after the other. It's just phenomenal what people live with. And then there's small sufferings of just simply being unhappy with the food that's served to you. The way that, you know, the fact that the carrots weren't cooked enough. That maybe is unpleasant, but there's going to be suffering about it. You can kind of complain, you start whining about the carrots. If you're whining about the carrots, even to a slight degree, there's suffering there. And so there's a full range. And so what's the clinging or the attachment that's been added to that situation that's maybe extra, that's not needed? And that's a big question, I think, for Buddhists, is what is the added element of clinging, attachment, craving, that is added to a situation which is not particularly needed in the situation itself? So what my proposal this evening is to say is that what Buddhism is concerned about, or what Buddhists are concerned about, is to pay very careful attention to suffering. And there's a kind of delight even, kind of willing delight, to investigate and understand suffering when it arises. Because when suffering arises, if you understand the suffering, you can understand the source of the suffering, the craving that's behind it, or the clinging, or the attachment, or the aversion, or the resistance. And then there's a possibility of letting go of that, or releasing that, or finding some freedom in the midst of that. And so we take it very seriously, not just simply, you know, monumental, catastrophic sufferings, but you can even take the very minute sufferings of life. The carrots, you know, they weren't cooked enough. If you're complaining about the carrots, that's interesting for a Buddhist to understand, oh, they're suffering also. Aha. And if they're suffering, what's the craving that goes with it? What's the clinging that goes with it? And so you explore that. And so what happens in a meditation practice or a mindfulness practice or in retreat is you begin seeing very subtly how the mind works. And how subtly the grasping or the craving or the addictions or the wanting or the obsessions or the fixations or the caught-upness of the mind, how those work and how those operate in our life over and over again. And to go through a whole series of synonyms like that, I think is interesting because you see very quickly what a common thread it is in many of our lives. These kinds of, you know, clinging and all those different permutations. So meditation retreat has a schedule. And mostly it's a schedule of sitting and walking and sitting and walking, and you have a meal, and then you go sitting and walking and sitting and walking, and then you have a meal, and then you're sitting and walking, and maybe someone gives a talk, and then you sit in the walk, and you go to sleep, and get up in the morning, you sit in the walk, and you sit in the walk. And so you're pretty busy. But there's a schedule you follow, and so at a certain point there's bells that get rung, and it tells you now you change activities. Now it's time to get up from your sitting and go walking. And in Vipassana, unlike in Zen, you don't have to listen to the bells. Someone rings the bell to end the sitting, and you know, who cares? And so you keep sitting. Or someone, whereas in Zen, if they ring the bell, you respond. And that's the practice. A big part of the practice is, you know, the bell rings, you go to the meditation hall, the bell rings and you stop meditating. But it's actually very wonderful to pay attention to what happens around when bells get struck at a meditation retreat. And actually it's also very interesting to just simply follow the schedule in kind of matter-of-fact way. So what I felt frequently was that at the end of the sitting, they'd ring the bell. And immediately, I was sitting quite calm, usually comfortable and nice. And as soon as the bell rang, this little voice of striving would arise and say, oh, I'm going to sit stronger now and really sit for another hour here. And really, I've got all this foundation of quiet sitting now. You know, I'll just go for it. You know, a little bit exaggerated, but there's a little, you know, excitement and clinging. You know, I wanted something different. I wanted to get something. And so, for the most part, I made the practice to more or less, you know, when the bell rang, I would get up and go to the next activity. In the leisurely way we do it in Vipassana. But what's interesting is, if you're sitting, for example, and you have tremendous bliss or happiness in your sitting, and if I would get up sometimes, and I get up and you're kind of discombobulated a little bit because you're getting up and it's complicated to get up and you have to get out of the room and step over the cushions and find your place and your shoes, and it's a major event. So, you know, so suddenly you lost track of, because you're looking for your shoes, you lost track of the bliss. And and so, you know, then you maybe feel disappointed, and disappointment is a suffering, right? Or maybe you feel the bliss, and so you're holding it tight and trying to kind of looking for the shoes just the right way so you can kind of keep the bliss kind of close by. And what you realize after a while is that, another opportunity is not to hold on to something like bliss or peace or calm or whatever, but rather be more interested in the non-clinging. And actually to find a deeper appreciation for not clinging than to any experience you might have in the sitting or in the meditation. So when you get up, can you find the non-clinging that allows your experience, your bliss, whatever, to disappear? And that's okay, because what you're relating to is a non-clinging, not to what's happening. And it's a very, it's an odd thing, because the non-clinging is invisible. You know, the bliss, you can kind of tangible and you feel it and you kind of point to it or something. But the non-clinging, what is it? Where are you going to find it? You're going to point to it and say, there it is? And what color does it have? Is it a shape? You know, it's kind of like it doesn't exist. It's not a thing, right? However, it's extremely important non-thing for Buddhists. It's a nothing. But that nothing is very important. It's very powerful and it offers a very deep kind of satisfaction, a way of being in life, to not to cling to what's going on to your experience. So then you want to cling to non-clinging. But that's impossible. It's kind of like you try to cling to non-clinging, it's kind of like trying to touch your right elbow with your right hand. You can't quite do it. You can end up kind of clinging, but then you're not clinging to non-clinging because, you know, you're clinging. So it's kind of a strange thing. And so I found myself at times letting go to some degree and just being there in a state of kind of more or less non-clinging. And finding it unfamiliar. And I think that in some ways it's appropriate to find yourself in an unfamiliar setting, unfamiliar environment, and there's no clinging at all. Because if you're not clinging, there's no expectation or no assumptions or no positions. And you don't really, in some sense, you don't know what's going on or what's going to happen next. There's no solid, attached way in which we're orienting ourselves to our reality. So some people come up against that edge and they get frightened. And they come up to that edge of uncertainty that comes with non-clinging. And it's like touching a hot grill, you know, just like a jerk reaction to pull back. But can you find kind of the trust that it takes to kind of be there in this uncertainty of non-clinging? Just kind of hang out there. Hmm. And what you see if you pay very careful attention, and you can see it most clearly, I think, on retreats, but anytime you pay careful attention, is you can see how the mind works and how thoughts work. And you can see thoughts arise and pass, and obsessions arise and pass, and fantasies arise and pass. And you get more and more familiar with this, and there's enough stillness after a while, you see it more and more carefully. And you start noticing how there's subtle kind of clinging or attachment to many of the thought forms that come up in our mind. And many of our thoughts have, there's kind of attachment, kind of attached or invested or caught up with that kind of thought, and off you go. And you can kind of sometimes feel the elasticity, the pull of being pulled away into that wonderful, alluring fantasy or whatever, you know, it might be. And Joseph at the retreat gave this wonderful analogy of that he thought up in one of his sittings, I guess, of just practicing kind of steadily along. And it's like driving on the freeway. You're kind of going straight in the freeway when you're going somewhere. But there's all these, billboards or advertisements on the side at the exit saying, come here for, you know, the best hamburger, and come here for buying the best gas, and come here, you know, for the best view or whatever. And so he would, you know, see these billboards on the freeway, and he'd go off on the exit and go, you know, spend some long time in the restaurant. And at some point he'd remember to come back on again. And after a while, he just noticed that he'd be going off the exit, and then he'd just go back right back on again. And after a while, he'd just see the billboard advertising, oh, you know, hamburgers. And he'd just say, oh, that's interesting. You see the billboard is trying to pull me off into that direction. But I don't have to do that. I want to go somewhere else. I'm trying to go, you know, down, you know, I don't know where he's going, this freeway, but... But that's kind of a nice analogy of how what you starts happening in meditation. You start seeing the mind in very subtle ways, how it wants to be pulled away into different kinds of thoughts and concerns and preoccupations, and how that you have a choice whether you do that or not. And as soon as you see there's a choice, and as soon as you see there's a before and after, that a thought, a preoccupation arises, is born, and at some point, in a second, a minute, 2 hours, at some point, it finally passes. You realize there's before and after to these things. And when you realize there's before and after to these things, you realize they're not the whole show. And part of the problem with thinking for many of us is we think our thinking is us. We're so caught up in our thinking so much that we think that thinking is our whole reality. So I was doing walking meditation at the retreat, going back and forth. You know, you can take a walk. In walking meditation, you walk back and forth a 30-foot kind of walkway. And, you know, pretty soon you've seen the vistas there. You know, it's, you know, so it's just you walking back and forth. And at some point, I had this thought or image or realization or feeling or whatever that, you know, I'd walked one pass, and then I was turning around to walk back again, and I was walking back in the same place where I'd been a few seconds before. And so I was kind of looking at the place I'd just been and remembering how I was caught up in some thought then. And where was that thought right now? I was just looking at empty space where I hadn't been, where thought had been a few seconds ago. Where was it? It was nowhere. It had gone, vanished. It was, you know, like... And then I thought, what about the thought that I'm obsessing about right now? Why does it seem to have such a huge monumental importance? And I'm so caught up in it and wrapped up in it and kind of lost in it and just kind of preoccupied in it. When actually in 2-3 seconds, it's going to be the same place as the one I'm looking at. You know, it's going to be not anywhere. It's going to be that wonderful empty place. And so you know, it became much lighter. And I didn't have to take these things so seriously and caught up in them, and realize there's much more to life than the world of our thoughts. And I think for most of us, we could say that intellectually, but for most of us, I think it's a real surprise to begin realizing that as our mindfulness and meditation deepen, that we're much more than our thoughts, and our thoughts actually limit us to a great degree. So in the first days of the retreat, I would open to this kind of spaciousness, transparency of kind of non-clinging. And non-clinging is also a way of kind of removing all the repression, all the stops on the heart and the mind. So then it gives the repressed stuff, all kinds of stuff, a chance to arise and to surface. And there's a whole series of things that might arise. And so I noticed one day that I kept feeling very sad. Not very, but I kept feeling sad when I would kind of open up and just be there in a very spacious and open way. So then I thought, well, so sadness is kind of a suffering, so what's that about? So I looked at that, and I felt that the sadness was, initially I felt the sadness was, 10 days is not very long for a retreat. You know, it felt sad, it wasn't long enough, I wanted, you know, a month or 3 months, 8 months. And, but that seemed a little bit abstract. So I kind of looked a little more carefully at what was going on. And then I felt that under that, or part of that, was kind of a sense or feeling that the present moment was not enough. It wasn't just simply that the retreat was not enough. The present moment was not enough. It wasn't enough just to be present for what was happening right here and now. And when I could see that, then I kind of relaxed, or kind of opened to that and felt that. And that kind of then kind of faded or passed or transformed itself into a kind of tender vulnerability, kind of tenderness, and a real appreciation then of each moment. And then for the next while of the day, I was very present. From each moment seemed like a wonderful mystery and wonderful delight. And, there was no need to be anywhere else to get anything else, which is often our operating mode for many of us. To be somewhere else, or try to get something else, and not be here. So you realize we see the thoughts, we see the beginning of a thought and the end of a thought, beginning of a fantasy and end of a fantasy, and we realize that there's spaces between that, and that the thoughts aren't constant. And you realize the space between that is also something, and it's also a precious thing. It's also something that holds maybe the thoughts, or holds the wider container. And so it's related to maybe to this thing of non-clinging. It's kind of this invisible thing. It doesn't really exist, but has a function, has a role in our life. It is a gateway to freedom. And so in Buddhism, I'll say it this way. When Buddhism distinguishes between the conditioned and the unconditioned world, and the conditioned world is the world of all our fabricated thought constructions, the ways we think and construct the world for ourselves. And most of us are preoccupied and lost in that world all the time. We think that's all there is. And so our attention is fixated on objects of thought constructions. And we're preoccupied with objects. The objects can be outside of us, the objects can be inside of us. Feelings, ideas, insights, or whatever. But in addition to the conditioned, constructed thoughts, kind of thought realm that we often relate to, there's that which is unconditioned, which is not constructed by our minds and our thoughts and our society. And the unconditioned is somehow this wider state of non-clinging that can hold all that or contain all that or is an alternative to all that. And so non-clinging is sometimes called various other things in Buddhism. It's called the timeless, the deathless. Because does time have anything to do with non-clinging? Does birth and death have anything to do with non-clinging, the birthless and deathless? Does the world of conditionality, of thought constructions, have anything to do with non-clinging? So what do we cling to? So there's a teacher, Ajahn Chah, stories of Ajahn Chah in Thailand, of him going around his monastery asking the monks, are you suffering today? And kind of very cheerfully, are you suffering today? And if someone said no, he'd say, oh, and he'd kind of go on. And then someone said, oh yes, I'm suffering today. And he said, oh, you must be clinging. So what is the clinging? What is the grasping? What is the obsessiveness? What is the fixation, the preoccupation? That is a kind of resistance to allowing things to be the way they are, to allowing them to unfold the way they are, or allowing our inner energy and our inner motivations and intentions to flow freely from us. What are those things? So Buddhism is a very strange religion because it has its kind of its highest goal, this thing that doesn't exist. So like, other religions have these wonderful things they can point to, you know. I mean, you know, I don't know, I don't want to pick on other religions, but you know, they have these wonderful ideals. And Buddhism has this ideal which is, it's not a thing. It's nothing. You know, so what do you say? You know, you can't hold it up to your friends and say, look at this wonderful jewel that I have, because it doesn't exist. Because non-clinging doesn't exist. Where do you find it? But it's very, very important for Buddhists. So there's an image in Buddhism of the lotus blossom, being kind of the image of enlightenment. And usually I think people focus on the lotus blossom as the whole beautiful open blossom. But I was thinking that part of what happens with an open flower blossom, it holds all the space. And in the space is all this possibility. And when the blossom is closed as a tight bud, there's no space, it's all tied up in itself. And because there's no space for anything to happen. When the flower opens, it creates all this openness and possibility. So when we become enlightened or awakened, or these are all words for the same thing as non-clinging, then it isn't so much, again, a thing, but it's a realm of possibility and openness. And so we try to find this openness that our life can live in. So I was coming down here today to give this talk on non-clinging, and I was thinking how wonderful it is to come and be able to talk to a group of a lot of people. You know, 10, 20 years ago, I would have been petrified and talk to so many people. But, you know, to come and talk to all these kind of people and not have any idea how my talk's going to be. You know, it might be terrible, it might be good, but I do this practice which is non-clinging. So, you know, so I have my feelings and thoughts, you know, things come up, but I do this practice of non-clinging, so it's okay.
What does non-clinging mean?
It means not holding on really tightly, that things have to be a certain way.
Just as expectations?
It's one of the elements that can be involved. Expectation is that if you expect something to happen and it has to happen, it's kind of holding, can be quite dangerous. Because expectations sometimes aren't fulfilled, and if they aren't fulfilled, you set yourself up for suffering. You can have goals and hopes that you kind of work towards without the expectation that it'll actually happen. So expectations, and what are the other words for clinging?
Is aversion a special kind of clinging?
Yeah, it can be. You don't want something, or you want something and something's threatening it, so you don't want it, so you're pushing it away. That's a kind of a clinging, kind of attachment.
If you have an idea of how things should be, that's a clinging.
It
should be a certain way.
I think if the word should, if you underline and put in italics, I would agree with you. And it's very dangerous, you just should, you know. And one Zen teacher I know had the teaching of it was just a nice little term, maybe a popular term. Don't should people, or don't should yourself. Don't live in shoulds. Yeah.
Is acceptance a synonym for non-clinging?
I would accept it as a synonym, but I use that word a lot because I'm very fond of it. I think we want to think carefully about why the Buddha was so reluctant to formulate the goal of the path in positive terms. It isn't that, you know, it's impossible, and Buddhists have, and Buddha did at times, But he was very careful to state it in negative terms. And one of the reasons, Joseph talked about this a little bit on his talk on Friday. Maybe, or maybe it was somewhere else. But he was deeply involved in the Theravada tradition that the mindfulness practice comes out of. And this tradition offers the practice of mindfulness within a certain metaphysical framework and of human psychology and perception and how the mind works and consciousness works and all these things. And it's kind of a metaphysics in the sense that no one really knows. And you find... So, you know, but it's a nice theory or a nice idea. And then he's been doing Tibetan practice for the last 4 or 5 years quite intensely, a practice called Dzogchen. And that has its own whole metaphysics about consciousness and awareness and objects and this and that. And so he's studying both of them, and he's trying to kind of match them, and he finds they don't match. They're different metaphysics. So, you know, what's going on here? He was confused, and he was quite concerned because he felt, you know, was one of them the teaching of the Mara then? It's one of the teachings of the devil, you know? And you know what? You know, he was very concerned and trying to figure it out. And the way he kind of figured it out for himself in the end was that metaphysics is not the point. And you can argue about metaphysics forever. But rather, what's the point is experience of non-clinging, of ending suffering. And throughout, there's a thread in Buddhism, I don't know if it's a continual thread, but there's a thread of many different traditions sharing in this description of enlightenment that involves a non-clinging. And you find in the Theravada texts, you find Mahayana texts and Zen texts, tremendous emphasis on a state of non-clinging. And you find the early historical Buddha being very reluctant and very suspicious of metaphysical claims. And if you don't have metaphysics, maybe you're better stating it negatively. And then what's there just can be there as it wishes to be there. And you just enjoy it. Someone else, I saw a hand.
Question was answered.
I imagine.
I'm not sure if you're saying this or not, but does it mean then if we are suffering, we're clinging? That if we're not clinging, we're not suffering?
Well, they have to understand definitions that we're using. So in Buddhist definitions of the word suffering, yes. And what that involves is that, but it's kind of like a definitional thing, you know, it's kind of like a tautology almost. Suffering for Buddhists is the pain that arises out of clinging. So therefore all suffering arises out of clinging, by definition. Now the distinction that's made in Buddhism is between, for example, is between pain and suffering. And there's a lot of pain in the world. There's pain of breaking your leg, there's pain of someone dying, and there's pain of grief, and there's many things which are kind of inevitable. But suffering has to do with the relationship we form with the conditions around us, with that pain. So it's one of the great lessons for this, for meditators, especially if you're willing to sit still a little bit in your meditation, is physical pain. And you start working with physical pain, you see there's a big difference between your physical pain and the suffering that you add to that, the self-pity, the aversion, the hate, and all those things. All those things are optional. You don't have to hate your pain. You don't have to feel sorry for yourself. So that's the suffering that Buddhism is concerned about. Does that make sense?
I have another question.
Yes.
Talk about your mission, the greatest attachment of all is to love.
The greatest attachment is love. I would prefer to say it if more like one of the great attachments we can have is the attachment to love. But then we have to define what words again. You know, what is love for you? And a lot of people associate love with attachment. But there are forms of love that involve no attachments, no desire for something for yourself, but rather a tremendous feeling of desiring the welfare and the kindness of others, and really appreciating the other person. And
I'm sure what you're saying, but that goal of that equanimity to great quality, you know, love, it's very hard. Some people mean more to us than others. And
yeah.
Reach that equanimity where they're balanced is very difficult.
Yeah, so we practice. It's a practice, right? And we're not too concerned about it. We just do. We practice the best we can, and you don't want to set up. You don't want to set up the goal of non-clinging as this headache for yourself. That it was just easy to do. You know, it's this wonderful idea. So all your clinging becomes a huge problem, and you just kind of get yourself into a deeper hole. Just, you know. So I like the synonym of acceptance. So rather than the way towards non-clinging is to accept your present condition. So if you're attached to someone you love a lot, start with accepting that rather than hating that or being upset about that, because then you've added another kink of clinging to it. Yes.
I've heard a lot about the aversion aspect of it, but my experience of non-clinging has to do with being present. It's not clinging to the moment, you know, letting go of the moment and entering the next moment as it appears.
Yes.
Continually letting go and entering and letting go and entering.
Well, you're not letting go of a moment, but you have to let go of again, your thought construction and your memory of what just happened, right? Yeah, for sure.
The distinction between non-clinging and not caring.
Non-clinging, not caring. So the wonderful
difference. Where is caring fit in relation to non-caring, to non-giving, non-clinging?
Non-clinging. Oh, I think if you don't cling, you can care a lot more. Because if you don't cling, then there's less of a agenda between you and what's going on. And there's less of an agenda. You can feel and be more connected to what's going on. Non-clinging brings connectedness. And there's connectedness, then there can be more caring. So there's a wonderful line by T.S. Eliot that says, "Teach me to care and not to care." So you do both. So what is caring for you? And caring can be worrying. And caring can be simply heartfelt desire for the welfare of someone else or the situation. And I think non-clinging, I said earlier that, you know, the state of non-clinging kind of removes kind of the lid for many of the stuff that's deeper within us. And I gave the example of my sadness that came up. But there's other things that can arise that are quite beautiful. Caring and concern and love and appreciation and peace and all these things. Try it.
It's pretty hard when you have a child and a child is miserable with an earache. Okay, I'm clinging to the idea that I want this earache to go away. It really meant for the child.
Uh-huh.
I'm not doing anything to me except that, you know, I have to do certain things. But that gets real close to clinging to the earache.
So you need to understand exactly where your suffering is then, and what your clinging is. If the child has an earache, there's suffering there. There's pain and there's suffering, and you can feel semi-empathetically. You can feel that pain, that suffering, and you can feel it's painful. It's painful sometimes to feel that. It has to be okay to feel the pain of the world. If it's not okay to feel the pain of the world, then you kind of push it away or try to do something with it, and that pushing it away or hating it or feeling self-pity or feeling this is unfair or whatever, that's adding a level of suffering to it. So can you simply first allow the pain to be there, and then allowing the pain to be there, can you figure out what the best response is? And you try to respond the best you can, and maybe you're successful to alleviate the pain, and maybe you're not. And if you're not, you're still left in a situation that's painful. But again, it's, you know, it has to be okay, because you did the best you can, and you continue trying to find out what you can do. So Buddhism doesn't guarantee that you're going to end pain. The pain might continue, but at least you're not adding the confusion that can come from suffering. And there's a lot of confusion that can come from suffering and clinging, it can actually make the whole situation much more difficult in some situations. And so I've seen situations with parents where a child cries and is upset or something, and the parent is so upset and so concerned, you know, because they're not a good parent and they're doing the right thing or they feel it's wrong or whatever, and they completely embrace the child in a pampered way, and the child is learning a certain message about the effectiveness of crying.
It's not the case with an earache, though.
No, I'm just changing subject slightly, but so some people are uncomfortable having someone cry, but maybe sometimes it's appropriate to let them cry, and not to kind of make it all complicated by adding your complicated stuff to that particular situation. Does this make sense to people? I'm not a parent, so. Yes?
But, I mean, we've all been children, whether we've been parents or not, and it's really important to have parents who can tolerate upset feelings and not get upset themselves.
Exactly.
It's a tremendous gift, you know, to give the gift of fearlessness.
Not just children, adults. I have a friend who cries really easily. She's an adult, and she cries, you know, very easily. It's beautiful. But when I first got to know her, she said, "I cry easily. Don't get so preoccupied. Don't, you know." So now, you know, it's, oh, she's crying, and so we just kind of continue the conversation. Yes, Elaine.
One of my big problems about suffering that I'm working on is how much projection of my own sufferings I put onto these another sufferer or animals, mostly the people too. And when I'm successful at withdrawing my own memories and baggage of despair and aloneness and helplessness, I feel almost cleansed in the sense that I am then empowered to take the reality and do something with it. Mm. Whether it's knowing I can't do anything and I'm sad just from the compassion of that this is a world of suffering. And I'll talk to God when I see her about that. but there. That's just the sadness of the world. But I find it such a... It isn't a disabling experience to feel that kind of sadness. It's a totally disabling experience to be projecting my own problems onto the sufferer. And then I can't move. I'm also finding that we're having huge troubles, like $2 million worth, with the IRS. And the fear that comes up, you better believe, is a number one practice material. And I hate to. It's so uncomfortable that I just refuse to live in it. And I have found it very calming and soothing. To after the wave hits, you know, we can't do anything while it's the top of the wave. But when as soon as it starts to slow down a little bit, to interject the metta and the metta starts to take place. And when it starts happening, there's a little separation that goes on about those people are suffering who are causing me to suffer. Not only right now, how far they wouldn't act that way. But heaven knows what's happening on their karma. And from the larger point of view, they are in big trouble. And I do wish them enlightenment and happiness so that they won't act this way anymore. It's a softening up and a freeing up. And then for myself, it's easy to say it's not awful that anybody should experience this. And just, I just get this sense of real love that's very much apart from the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel, in those conditions, I feel very strongly what you're talking about is non-clinging. Because what's happening in the world doesn't matter. It's the beauty and strength is in this love. And then when things, all kinds of good things happen, and I think, oh boy, we're getting a handle on this, so the reflex action of relief of pain. Oh boy, no more pain. And I'm right back where I started.
Yes.
in terms of being susceptible to everything. Yes.
So I'd like to end then with kind of request, maybe perhaps, that you take suffering very seriously. And not only the obvious kinds of suffering that you may be often concerned with, but even the very minute sufferings. Because the very minute sufferings are happening constantly, moment by moment. And if they're invisible, unattended to, there's the development of habit that happens, little kink, little moment after a time. And so if you start noticing your little complaints about the carrots, and noticing those more and more, and find ways of releasing and opening up in the midst of these small ones, you'll suddenly see its value in the subtleties of your life also. So thank you all very much.